what's happening here? This isn't a cult.
What? Hallie, I can't do anything that's not cult related.
It makes your job at a preschool really difficult.
Okay. All right. Well, I'm a little nervous. What do you have planned for me?
This is the beginning of a mini series we're going to be doing called Obsessed.
Ooh, I like obsessions.
Now, we know that cults actually tend to form a lot from fixation on certain ideas.
I've heard of that. That rings true.
So I figured it sort of kept in our theme, and we can talk about people, famous individuals, who took the fixation to the next level, sometimes deadly, sometimes attempted deadly.
All right, I'm into that.
So, I mean, and I think obsession is really interesting just on a brain level.
Do you get obsessed with things? I know the answer to this from the look you gave me that is so tired. But for the benefit of the listener,
yes.
Hallie, have you ever been obsessed with something?
A little bit. I say that I have ADD, which tends to lead to me getting hyper fixated on things. That's mm-hmm. a fun, real symptom. You can look that up. And when I was 12 years old, I was so obsessed with the Percy Jackson and the Olympian novels, I would not talk about anything else. Saucy's nodding. She was there.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I would bring it up at school. I would bring it up at sleepovers. I would bring it up at Girl Scout meetings. I would talk about it all the time at dinner. I owned a Camp Half-Blood t-shirt that was signed by Rick Riordan. I think it's still in my attic.
And who possibly could have scrounged up a Camp Half-Blood shirt for you?
It was made for me by Stassi as a gift.
Oh my God, what a cool friend, you guys.
So I've always been really interested in what makes my brain do that and what makes other people's brains do that. By the way, sidebar, the Percy Jackson movies were an affront to God and this country.
Absolute garbage.
And someday they should make a series of unfortunate events type miniseries on Netflix to make up for it.
I feel like those I wasn't into.
So today I'm going to tell Stassi a story and she's going to tell me one.
Ooh, okay.
So, I like this. Mine is about one of the most famous cases of obsession in American history, John Hinckley Jr.
This is the Jodie Foster guy.
Yes.
Okay. What do I know about him?
I was going to say, when you hear that name, what comes to mind?
I am unworthy of your love, Jodie darling.
Musical assassins. I knew that was going to be your answer.
Yep. And that is pretty much it.
All right. Well, let's dive in a little bit more.
Let's do it.
So there is really something so quintessentially American about this case, both the way it ends, the way it starts. There's so much Hollywood involved.
Ugh, love it.
So many acts of gun violence. Again, quintessentially American. So John Warnock Hinckley Jr.
Yes. Classic name.
He was. And I keep thinking it's his Womnock, which isn't a name. My glasses are too far away. He was born May 29th, 1955 in Ardmore, Texas.
Okay.
He was the youngest of three kids, and by all accounts, he had a pretty normal childhood.
Okay.
His mom was a housewife. His dad was actually the president of World Vision United States, and he was chairman and president of Vanderbilt Energy Corporation.
So a well-off family.
They were very well-off, just okay. Very all-American.
Huh, I did not know. I would have assumed, I don't know why, I just would have assumed poor family, just because I'm just biased or prejudiced, and that I would assume that a crazy guy like John Hinckley Jr. would not have been so affluent.
Yeah, it's sort of this image a lot of people have of someone who becomes a violent person is not this. John played soccer, football, hockey. He could play piano. He was elected class president twice.
Wow. Okay, so he was more than sane.
Yeah, he was very popular, very personable. He was completely normal in high school.
Interesting.
It was after high school that he started to go a little hinky. Pardon the almost fun. A little hinkly. Between 1974, when he graduated high school, and 1980, he kept enrolling and dropping out and enrolling and dropping out of Texas Tech University.
Okay.
He moved to LA briefly to try to become a songwriter.
Oi.
Because that always works.
You gotta. I mean, someone's gotta do it. You either move to LA or New York.
You know who does it? Like, they hire people now. Like, you don't just show up with, like, a song in your heart. It's always just, like, it's very strategic.
It was very calculated.
Yes, and he yeah. did not know how to get into any of that. His parents say he frequently wrote to them talking about how it wasn't working out, how he needed money, how he couldn't make any contacts in the song networked. Industry. He wasn't networking, is my point, et cetera, et cetera. So around this time when he was writing to them talking about how difficult it was to break into songwriting, he also said he had a girlfriend named Lynn Collins. But it turns out she didn't exist. This was just a lie he told, completely fabricated.
Ooh, fun, comfy. Oh,
yeah.
That's always a good place to be in.
And that's one of those things, I don't know, maybe other people's parents really care about that, but like, I don't feel like I would make up a girlfriend or a boyfriend or whoever to please my parents.
If I did, my parents would be like, we need to have you sectioned, I think.
Yeah.
Because that is insane.
It's a little bit weird. And it does, I looked all over and it didn't go into like how they found out about this, but.
Was he displaying any other like weird tendencies at this point? Or was this like kind of the first start of the snowball?
Well, in 1976, about midway through these lost years, when he was 21, he moved back home with his parents for a while and started being treated for depression. And so they figured at the time that this was just him acting out because he felt like he needed attention or he needed somebody to love him. And so he made this up in like his depressed brain. So they wrote this off as like, he's just kind of being aimless. He's 20. He's just a little lost. So we're going to get through this. So shortly after moving home in the mid 70s, Hinckley saw the movie Taxi Driver in theaters, an event that would change his entire life.
Have you ever seen that?
I have not.
Nor have I.
It is an incredibly famous movie.
Mm-hmm.
For those who haven't seen the film, it centers around Robert De Niro's. I almost said Rob De Niro, like we're buddies.
Your good friend.
Me and Bobby. So Robert De Niro's character, the titular taxi driver, is plotting to kill a presidential candidate.
Okay.
This is actually based off of the attempted assassination of George Wallace a few years earlier.
Is this the one where he's like, you talking to me in the mirror?
Yes.
Okay, that's what I thought.
That's him. In this movie, a then 13-year-old Jodie Foster plays a child prostitute named Iris.
Iris.
This was an acclaimed performance. People were shocked that this little girl was playing such a dark role so well. She ended up winning a BAFTA and being nominated for an Oscar at this role when she was 13. So I think she broke some records with this. Now, Hinckley became obsessed with her.
Oy.
Cue the title. There are records that he saw Taxi Driver at least 15 times, but it's possible he saw it more.
Wow.
This was a time where you couldn't buy a movie on DVD or VHS or whatever. They would just play it for a really long time in the theater, and then it was gone until they decided to show it again.
Mm-hmm.
So he basically lived at the theater this whole time this movie was playing.
Oy, wow. Okay. So he's a bit obsessed.
A little bit. He also began to mimic De Niro's character in the film, Travis Bickle. Okay. He would wear the same clothes he wears in the movie. He drank peach brandy that the character drinks, which sounds fucking disgusting.
That just made my stomach turn.
Right? Like, I love
the words peach brandy. I was like,
those shouldn't even be in the same sentence, let alone like one thing.
I'm sorry to the two people out there who's like, hey, that's my drink, man.
I want to ask, who hurt you? Did you burn half your taste buds off as a child and never really recover? He also started to amass a huge collection of firearms.
Oh boy. Okay. Not good. Not good.
He decided the best way to continue to live out this fantasy of being Travis Bickle was to befriend the girl who played Iris. So he integrates himself into Jodie Foster's real life. He actually managed to talk to her on the phone twice because this was the 70s and it was easier to just look people up in the phone book and there was no caller ID.
So,
and again, she was a child. She was a little girl, and so she lived with her parents.
Right.
So you could look up the Fosters and find her.
Wow. Okay, that's fucked up.
Super fucked up, and it's also, I think, the reason now that celebrities are so cagey.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So, you'd have to be.
Yeah.
Oh, fuck.
He talks to her on the phone. He says he was Napoleon and she was his Josephine.
Ooh, weird, those are the lovers you want to go
weird
with.
Weird pick, yeah, right? Not Romeo and Juliet.
Also not a great example.
Not a great example, but definitely one people go to more as like someone who had a passionate romance.
Local Bobby gives thumbs up to teen suicide. Hallie and I were just watching Hot Fuzz.
For like the 17th time.
Okay.
So he told her these things. She was understandably super weirded out and hung up on him both times. he didn't give up.
That's not a straight answer, is it?
No.
That she didn't say yes yet, which she inevitably will, of
course. An eighth grader, confusingly, was not interested in hanging out with him.
Fuck, it's just making my skin crawl just the thought of it.
He sent her letters, poems. He made dozens of calls to any numbers that were even tangentially related to her.
Okay.
When she went to Yale University when she was 18, he decided to follow her there. He moves to New Haven. He broke into her dorm. He memorized her class schedule. He even enrolled in a writing class at Yale so he could just stare at her all the time.
Wow.
Could you imagine being in your class and this guy is just sitting there, like, giving you, like, I want to consume you eyes?
And she still doesn't know him.
No. She knows who he is at this point as, like, her stalker.
Okay.
Because he will not leave her alone. And it's been going on for about 5 years now.
Does she have any kind of, like, bodyguard? Any protection?
I was going to say that. It eventually got so bad she had to be accompanied by bodyguards around the campus just for her own personal safety.
Yeah.
At this point, it is 1980.
Okay.
He has been trying to get this teenage girl to fall in love with him for years with no avail.
Wow.
So he decides to change tactics. This is actually what he's doing is part of a real mental disorder that's called erotomania, which sounds like the name of a sex shop, but it's not.
Can you spell that for me?
Sure. It's erotomania.
Okay, thank you.
It's a delusion where the person suffering believes that a famous person or a character in a television show is in love with them and is communicating to them through subtle gestures or coded messages in whatever they're watching.
I think I've heard of this.
It's pretty common in, like, films and stuff. Like, it's been on Criminal Intent. Now, what is the dumb show my sister loves? Paget Brewster was on it. Criminal Minds.
Okay.
So there's like, shows like that they sort of portray this as, because it's interesting to people. This sort of delusion.
This would be quite rare, I would assume.
It's not very common at all. Okay. It's usually part of, like, a bigger thing, like schizophrenia or something like that.
I was going to say, he sounds a little, like, I could see that being...
Yeah.
Okay, continue.
So he interprets her total lack of interest in him as a sign that she is not interested in him because he hasn't made himself an equal to her yet in fame and notoriety, and she's telling him with this, I am terrified of you behavior.
With zero communication.
Yes.
Yeah.
That he needs to do something big to sort of get into her good graces.
Okay. So, I'm sure it's going to be totally normal, like open a cupcake shop.
Close.
Okay.
Hankley decided he was going to make Foster notice him with a grand gesture of assassinating the president of the United States.
Oh boy.
Just like Travis Bickle did. Now, originally he wanted to kill Jimmy Carter.
Okay.
And he stalked him for a very, very long time.
Okay.
He said that he was crazy easy to get unfettered access to. Because again, it was just back in the day. It was less typed up as it is now. And he said at one point he was a foot away from him.
Oh, that is very unsettling.
Very, very close. He was, however, arrested in October of 1980 at the Nashville International Airport.
Mm-hmm.
He was actually arrested for his illegal possession of firearms because he had gathered a whole bunch at this point, just stalked him away.
Mm-hmm.
Carter had actually made a campaign stop there in Nashville, which is why he was there. But the FBI didn't connect this.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of nobody, because nobody connected that he was there for the president, nobody reported it to Secret Service. Hey, look out for this guy.
Okay.
Now, his parents obviously found out about this because he got arrested. And so they put him under psychiatric care very briefly, but he was released super quickly afterwards.
Well, better sorry than safe, you know?
I mean, I do have to give props to his parents just because they were trying. Like, they noticed something wasn't quite right.
They were 70s trying.
Yes.
Or, excuse me, 80s trying.
Yes, early 80s trying.
Yeah.
They're like, we took you to a shrink twice. What else do you want?
Yes. Okay, great.
Now, Carter lost re-election, so he was like, you're no longer president. I'm no longer interested in you. The new target was the second worst TV personality to ever darken the White House.
Okay.
Ronald Reagan.
Oh, boy.
March 30th, 1981. President Reagan is giving a speech to a gathering of the American Federation of Labor and Congress. Big, long name. It was basically this big meeting for, like, blanket unions and people in charge of labor for the country.
Okay.
At the Washington Hilton Hotel in D.C.
Love D.C.
You do love DC. Your sister went to college down there.
I was just there this weekend.
For her sister's graduation.
She graduated summa cum laude.
Mazel tov, Coley.
Thank you.
You're not going to hear this.
She's not going to listen to this.
Hinckley arrived in DC the night before after reading about Reagan's schedule of events in the paper. While he was waiting for the president, he wrote this 2-page letter to Foster. Mm-hmm. And this is a quote that I have from it.
Oh, love it. Okay.
I would abandon the idea of getting Reagan in a second if only I could win your heart and live out the rest of my life with you.
Oh, boy.
Now, ironically, the hotel, the Hilton Hotel there,
yeah,
was considered incredibly safe and one of the most secure places in the entirety of DC because of this secure enclosed passageway that was actually called the President's Walk.
Okay.
It was built after the JFK assassination, and it was basically, it walked you, once you left the hotel, it walked you farther out while you were, like, completely shielded. Just sort of like this tunnel.
Very secure. So people are maybe not on their, they're not really, like, on high alert.
Yeah.
Okay.
So because of this secure tunnel that sort of juts out from the hotel, Reagan entered the building through the passageway, and he exited through the passageway, and he literally only had to be outside away from his car for 30 feet. The Secret Service didn't even have their bulletproof vests on. Like, it was such a short walk that nobody thought there was anything to worry about.
Okay, so they're really not on high alert. Okay.
Now, Hinckley was in this small crowd that had sort of gathered outside to, you know, see the president. Mm-hmm. And he wasn't acting weird or fidgety like Mark Chappell, who killed John Lennon, was acting like a psycho right beforehand.
Okay.
But he was acting completely normal. By pure coincidence, another unnamed bystander was acting weird.
Ooh.
Just acting kind of fidgety. And so Secret Service was so focused on that guy.
In, yeah.
That Hinckley attacked.
Wow.
There's so many things that happened here.
Yeah.
In this story that were just pure luck. He shot Reagan.
Yes.
He shot Reagan's press secretary, James Brady.
Yes.
He shot a DC police officer, and he shot 2 Secret Service agents.
So he's just going for it.
Yeah, before this he was subdued.
This is not like one and done. He's just kind of trying to cause a huge... Is he trying to kill all these people?
Or he's trying to kill Reagan, but Reagan is surrounded by so many people. And a lot of times in the heat of the moment, when people do something crazy like this, the plan goes out the window. And they just start aiming for, like, blind carnage.
Okay, okay.
So I don't know what was happening in his head at the time, but he did shoot a ton of people.
Okay.
He was actually subdued by a guy named Alfred Antonucci, and he was just a Cleveland labor union official who had been at the dinner.
Sure.
No, like... self-defense training or whatever. He jumped on his back. Nice. And he knocked him down.
Thank you, man.
And he wouldn't let go until the agents pried him off because he said he wanted to avoid another Lee Harvey Oswald situation.
Right.
And that had only been 17 years before. So for a lot of people, this was something they remembered, something they'd sort of grown up in their head of, I don't want this to happen again.
Yeah.
Now, Reagan himself had a partially collapsed lung, and 3 officers sustained minor injuries. They also recovered. All 4 of them recovered from that.
Okay.
James Brady had the worst of it.
Ooh.
He was shot in the head.
Oh, my God.
He suffered brain damage. He was confined to a wheelchair for the rest of his life.
Oh, you can see, he survived.
You can see stuff that was on TV about him in later life, and he was having a tough time. It was like a really horrible stroke, almost, is what he sounded like.
That sucks.
He stayed the press secretary, but, like, in name only for the rest of Reagan's terms out of, like, respect, because he was, like, fucked up.
Aww.
And he was for the rest of his life. In fact, when he died in 2014, it was because of complications from his injuries. So it was ruled by the coroner a homicide.
Yeah, because that they'll do that if it's related.
So from... John Hinckley Jr. killed James Brady.
Wow.
It just took decades for it to happen.
Wow.
Reagan went on to live for another 24 years and was a terrible president.
Did great things.
That's not relevant, but I like to bring it up. Jodie Foster continued to thrive as an actress, and now she has a wife and 2 kids. And the Brady Bill was the only piece of gun control legislation ever passed by Republicans.
Oof.
It says that you have to wait 5 days before purchasing a gun. It's also incredibly easy to work around this if you just go to a gun show. So, like, great virtue signaling, guys. Jodie Foster was actually, she was in her teens, early 20s at this point. She was forced to testify at the trial.
Oh, God.
Which was incredibly stressful for her because...
That must be traumatizing.
She was getting hounded at college. People were coming. They needed even more bodyguards. They're like, this is your fault. You almost killed the president. Like, they were blaming her for a ton of this stuff.
That's cool. And that makes sense.
Yeah.
So I get it, guys.
And then other people were just more obsessed, were interested in what do you know about this guy? What did you have to do with this?
Mm-hmm.
So during her testifying, they found obviously she was at no fault of anything that happened.
Right.
She to this day will refuse to talk about Hinckley. If you ask her about an interview, she'll get up and leave. So that's sort of where she is about this. Hinckley was found not guilty by reason of insanity,
mm-hmm.
and he was sent to St. Elizabeth's, which is a very famous psychiatric hospital in D.C.
Mm-hmm.
He was sent there in 1982. He resisted treatment for a very long time and was actually pen pals with Ted Bundy.
Holy fuck! Are you kidding me?
I'm not kidding you, birds of a feather.
Oh, wow.
Until Ben Bundy was electrocuted to death in 1989. He made some progress in the 90s, sort of mentally. But then the hospital staff found he had somehow squirreled away 52 pictures of Jodie Foster in his room.
Holy fuck. In the 90s they found this? Wow. So he never
really let go.
That boggles my mind.
So that set him back some. And then on November 16th, 2018, after years and years of increasingly long visits away from the hospital, he was released from St. Elizabeth's after 35 years to live with his elderly mother in Virginia. And that is where he is now.
Oh, I'm sure she really appreciates that.
Yeah, I'm sure she's really into that. And Jodie Foster, understandably, has a restraining order.
Oh, my God.
And that is the story of John Hinckley Jr.
Wow. That's pretty fucked. If you feel you're very obsessed with a celebrity or you think they're obsessed with you, try to avoid it avoid them for a few days.
And maybe talk to a therapist.
Yeah. See how you feel without that celebrity in your life. It's weird when people are like really into celebrities. It freaks me out a little bit.
Me too.
Okay. Thank you.
Unless it's us and you should only be into us and like you want to give us money and gifts and like, I don't know.
Shoot the president for us.
You said it.
That was a joke. Thank you. Bye.
Secret Service.
Remember to join us next week for Stassi's story of obsession in part 2 of our series. It involves astronauts, so that's always a good one. Also, a reminder to check out our other podcast. It is called The Society Pages, and the link is available in the description of this episode. We are very proud of it. We recorded it all over the place, including in a barn, at a lake, and in a sealed room with no air conditioning on a day when it was 90 degrees, so we'd love if you could check it out. Thank you.